Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Bob, just so you know, Bob is where all the good music comes from. And if you missed the first hour, you should catch it on the archive because the music was super fun. The information was fabulous. We talked with some guys that are a part of the Trump transition team with national security and border security in specific. And
totally not enough time.
Totally not enough time. But they do have a lot of information because they all do. They also do IT cybersecurity stuff, IT consulting and cybersecurity. And they have a lot of information about the Awan brothers, the Pakistani brothers who worked for Debbie Wasserman Schultz and 79 other members of the House. And if you haven't been following that story, their last name is spelled A-W-A-N. I would go to the Daily Caller and look up A-W-A-N and begin reading the stories because it is awesome.
Yeah. If you go to school and get a little degree in IT, you can get a job anywhere.
No, you can work at McDonald's and do that.
And like, do just, that.
Oh,
it's
oh
yeah.
You got, it'll blow your mind.
Yeah.
When we do that show, I do hope everyone tunes in. It's really worth its weight in gold. However, this hour, we have Ryan Morrow with us from, he is the Clarion Project's Shulman Fellow. I do not know what that means. He's going to have to tell us about that. He's also a national security analyst. I kind of get what that's for. But and so I'll just read you the little beginning here that brought him to us. President Trump's speech at the UN is being rightly praised, with some even saying it's his best speech as commander-in-chief so far. I'll leave the rest and the reasoning behind on that. And I also posted Ryan's article on the Clarion Project. It's on our website, wethepeopleradio.us. So, with that minor introduction, hi, Ryan.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. It's always nice. You know, it's a lot of times people don't catch all of these things that are printed out there, and it's always nice to hear from the person who wrote it and who had the idea. So,
yeah. Well, what can I say? I'm obsessed with this topic of Islamic extremism and all the issues that intersect with it. And that's what I do full-time for the Clarion Project. So the title of Shulman Fellow is basically to cover not just the analytical work I do in terms of media and what you see on the website with the articles I write, but also the behind-the-scenes stuff that I do. It's a reference to things like advising policymakers, government agencies, and doing basically intelligence distribution, where through different sources I have and different methods, we get information on different extremist threats, and then we get it to the law enforcement agencies that are just overwhelmed with information. And so, believe it or not, civilians outside the government can do a lot if they know what they're doing, or they just happen to be in the right spot at the right moment and see something and then report it.
That's awesome. And so tell people a little give people a snapshot. The Clarion Project does what?
We've been around since 2006, 2007, before I joined, and we came out with these documentaries that got a lot of attention, so that's what the organization is most known for. The first documentary was Obsession, which aired on CNN and Fox and was mailed across the country, millions and millions of copies, and it was all about Islamic extremism as told through what appears on Middle Eastern television. So it was mostly just clips explaining the different issues and what this ideology is and how it operates using the radical cleric's own words. So it was really compelling and groundbreaking at that time. And then since then, we've come out with other films like The Third Jihad, which is narrated by a moderate Muslim activist, Zudi Jasser, who is frequently in the media. Iranium about Iran. Honor Diaries about the persecution of women in the Muslim world. And Faith Keepers, which is about the persecution of Christians and other minorities.
Nice. Well, if people look through our archives, we've done a bunch of shows on that to the point where I'm sure we're probably on some hater list.
Someplace. We got to be on a hit list somewhere.
So yes, we should probably have you back several times.
Are we on the Southern Poverty Law Center list yet?
We aren't on the Southern Poverty Law Center list yet, but you know we're trying.
We're rookies.
Seeing if we can get up there.
Yeah.
It's not that hard these days, so be hopeful, because they're just throwing everyone on that list. It's amazing. It's like half the country are apparently Nazis, KKK members,
well, crap,
and
maybe we are
haters.
On there.
Anyway, we got to double check.
I'm just joking. I never actually did look. We probably are. Because a friend of mine, I found out, is like person number six or something. It's like, oh, wow.
There's somebody.
You're killing it.
So let's unpack this this speech. Because, President Trump's UN speech.
Because you either heard it was great, or you heard that it was just, you know, humiliating and just embarrassed America and all that.
Well,
so.
All the talk was this is going to be
scary.
This is going to be the speech that just shows him as the buffoon he is, and it turned out
that it was really good.
It was just the opposite.
Sure. Well, there have been two really good speeches by Trump recently, which was the first was the UN speech, which I think in terms of a speech on international affairs beats anything since Reagan. Maybe not in delivery because it's Trump, but you have to print it. If you print it out and you read it,
yeah.
It's really amazing. And so I've read it more than I've watched it. And then you had the speech about Iran. But one of the things that happens here, especially in cable news, is that the booking strategy for these speeches is a lot of the segments is they'll bring on a Republican political strategist, like that's their job, and the Democratic political strategist, and their job is to just argue about it. And so just by nature of that process, you already have people that are going off of talking points and whose job it is to play that role. Rather than bringing on immediately after just objective analysts that aren't playing that game. And so that's why no matter what Trump or even Obama did, you would get these kind of predictable criticisms no matter what. But the UN speech was very different from other speeches I've seen. And if you understand the language of third world dictators in the Middle East, it hit most of the right points. The only criticism that I had was that the Sunni Islamists, like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, really seem to get off the hook, but there's a strategic consideration there, which is that we want to ally with them against Iran. And I don't agree with that logic. I think we can do a bunch of things all at once, but that's probably the consideration behind Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey not being held accountable by Trump in the speech. But when it came to talking about Iran and North Korea and Venezuela and some of these other issues, it was really amazing to see, and I think in my article I wrote of, I think it was at least 10 lines that I thought were just mind-blowing in how articulate and nuanced they were, thanks to speechwriters and advisors, granted, but still they were in there. The president still authorizes what goes in there at the end of the day.
Sure. And he had the guts to say it. I mean, that's, you know, I think the overwhelming view was he's going to isolate us from everybody with this speech, and that didn't really happen, did it?
No, that's because other countries aren't as sensitive and dramatic as we are. We act
right.
Like some undiplomatic language and some insulting is going to cause another country to become so hurt that they're going to stop thinking about their own interests and what's best for their country, and it's going to isolate us. It doesn't work that
or
way.
They're no. Gonna,
example,
or they're just going to have a tantrum and start a war with us because somebody was mean to them.
Because we microaggressed them.
Yeah, exactly.
We're projecting that sensitivity,
space.
Buffoonery that's going on in American culture onto other places. And it's just not that way. Like, when you hear Trump talking about the Iran deal and European countries who are making a lot of money off that deal just going ballistic and saying, oh, this is so undiplomatic. Well, guess what? It doesn't actually matter, because at the end of the day, if you have to choose between the U.S. or Iran to invest in, you're going to go with the U.S.
Yeah.
And up until that point, especially if you're a businessman, you're going to be screaming because you want to invest in both and make as much money as possible. And so sometimes a lot of the song and dance that you see is very predictable from these governments and from leaders that are condemning something that the United States does, flipping out over something that Trump does, and those that think it matters are just exaggerating it, because at the end of the day, it doesn't change the calculation of the country that you're talking about.
No, and I think that's a really good point. What's in the best interest of the country? You know, everybody was up in arms over the conversations he was having with Canada, like Canada was going to turn their back on us. You know what? I don't think there's a lot of countries out there that are going to run the other way from the United States. I mean, they know what's good for them. They may not like the new rules, but they're still going to hang with the United States, invest with the United States, because it's in their best interest. I mean, that's bottom line.
Yeah, I think so, and I think being tough in order to get that to set those rules for countries like North Korea and Iran and frankly, even the UN and international dynamics as a whole, just that posture is very positive. And while you're also hearing screaming and condemnations coming from around the world, you are seeing certain things happen, like China becoming more cooperative with North Korea, Pakistan becoming a little bit more cooperative. Iran just said that they're willing to negotiate over their ballistic missile program. Behind the panic that you see that gets the TV news segments, that dominates the headlines because you can take a pithy quote and make it into a good news story, if you look at actual behavior, you see that that panic that Trump causes actually results in changes of behavior. And so in many cases it works. In many cases it doesn't when you're impulsive, but the stuff that people are complaining about, it's the stuff that actually seems to work. And it's really interesting to see that dynamic play out. One concern I do have is there is a prevailing perception, particularly within the Middle East, that the U.S. is still not a reliable friend and that we're still not willing to shake up the status quo in a substantive way. And the best example of that, I think, it would be the Muslim Brotherhood, which is like the biggest radical Islamic movement across the world, where a lot of our friends that are combating them expected Trump to call them a terrorist group and to take action against them, and that hasn't happened. In Iraq and Syria, our best allies are the Kurds, and yet, just like under Obama, we are still kissing the feet of the dictator of Turkey and not backing the Kurds. And so there is a lot of hope among friends of ours in the region, but I am seeing a simmering disappointment and a belief that, you know what, maybe it doesn't matter who's president of the United States. Maybe there's just the U.S. is just kind of controlled by someone behind the scenes, and the president is just a puppet. And that's kind of the perception, because you don't see these big changes from administration to administration. So I hope Trump does, you know, starts thinking about how to shake up the region and starts thinking about matching that rhetoric with some really dynamic action.
I think it's just nice that there's a massive shift from the Obama era, you know, that all that nicey-nice and all the bowing and stuff. I think most people were just so frustrated with that. It's very very refreshing to hear somebody speak plainly. It's nice. So we have to take a really swift break. Or don't we? Mm-hmm. Do we? I didn't wait till I got the high sign. I got the high sign. We'll take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Ryan Morrow, from the Clarion Project. And I'm sure we'll extend beyond the UN speech, but we'll go wherever Ryan takes us, because he's a smart guy and has tons of information. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a damn's busted. Oh, baby, come on. It's so neat to meet your baby where the action is. In every little town across the USA, there's a spot where the
I like it.
Every day.
That's where Ryan lives, where all the action is.
Come on down and listen.
listen to the guitars
play. Is he on radio silence?
No, he's here.
Are you ignoring us, Ryan?
No, I didn't want to laugh into the phone and then interrupt the music.
That's okay, that's the goofing off portion. That's our cover. See, that's how we get to talk about all these serious, depressing issues without, you know, actually causing mental health problems for our audience.
Yeah, I've learned in my public presentations, especially like speaking engagements where it goes on for like 45 minutes or an hour, that I have to always end on with basically a list of like 20 positive things that are happening. Otherwise, it's just so dreary and it's just,
yeah.
You know, people don't like it, even if they're interested in the topic. I mean, how much of it can you handle?
Exactly. That's exactly it. So we do like to talk about a lot of topics that are sometimes unsolvable. I mean, not everything has a, you know, a bow at the end, but it doesn't mean we have to be, you know, nasty while we do it.
You need a twisted sense of humor.
Yep.
That not everybody's going to understand as a coping mechanism, and just know that's going to come with the territory when you study this stuff, and you've got to... honestly, I mean, the majority of people that study this stuff, by the time they get to their mid-50s, and I've seen this happen to people, they really start losing their minds.
And really?
Hey, wait a minute, I'm 56. What
Hello.
Are you saying?
So, but are you studying, like, terrorism all the time?
No, thank God.
Negative stuff? Or, like, even just people that are studying politics from an angle of, like, always complaining? And if you don't make that daily commitment of finding something funny or finding some silver lining in all of this, it's going to do damage to your psyche. And I'm sure that that's damaging the psyche of the country as a whole just because you have a 24/7 news cycle now. And I don't know what those effects are, but I'm sure there's some effects going on that we're not measuring.
I can see it in their driving.
Right.
I think if we really want to spot it in its most raw form, we just go out on the roadway. And just watch how people act. It's like,
that's actually kind of a fair way of looking at it, because it's not going to come out in this way where someone says, "How are you?" You're going to be like, "Oh, I'm so upset over Iran and Burma and North." It's like that's just not how it happens.
That's right.
It's going to come out in these like in these more subtle ways where there's a slight frustration, then you flip out over it.
Yeah.
So road rage actually is a pretty good way. I think that's a fair correlation.
They're not going to give you the finger in church, but they might run you over in the parking lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's always a lot of that. It's always been true, but I think it's more true now. And I do think, being someone in my mid-50s, that I was talking to someone about that the other day. I said, hey, you know, you're old like I am. Remember back in the day when you went home from work and, like, then work was over because it was at work and it couldn't find you? Like, if you were out mowing the grass or you were, you know, walking your dog or doing something, your work couldn't get a hold of you because there was no cell phone. There was a phone on the wall in your kitchen. And we didn't even have call waiting for a long time. When my kids were little, there was no call waiting.
Shoot, we had a party line.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you can't be on the phone because my husband at that time was a truck driver and he was waiting to be dispatched. So no one could use the phone at night because the dispatcher might call. And I just laugh. Now, you know, the other night the phone rang at like 10:30 and Bill goes, "Doesn't anybody at your work ever sleep?"
Like, those are the good old days.
I'm like, no, not really. But it's true, though.
No.
You know,
constant communication.
I was looking at something someone made for an auction last night up at in our congressional district here. And someone had made some really cool auction items. And the one lady goes, "I used to make things like that." And I was like, gee, so did I. But then they invented email. And it, like, ruined my life.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And what the problem I have is that the 9-to-5 thing doesn't work for me because my brain just doesn't always hyper-focus like it needs to for, like, brain-intensive work.
Yep.
So 9-to-5 jobs don't really work with my personality.
They don't work with my sleep habits and my fun either.
What's that?
Yeah, they don't work with my sleep habits, my fun, my interest level. I'm not always interested at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, all right, so then you ditch the 9-to-5 thing, but now you're 24/7.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And those are the two choices you have for your career and lifestyle, and both are terrible.
It's kind of funny, though. If you do things that you really like, the bad part is it integrates into your life because then you're doing it all the time. But the nice part is you don't resent it. It isn't like, oh, it's work calling.
Your friends and family do.
Well, you just cut back on them. You got to cut back on that.
That's what they make email for.
I can remember like maybe 10 or 15 like really awesome times I had with my friends since the age of 21.
Yeah, I only really am friends with people I work with. You got to just cut back on the other people. They're just kind of, you know, they're just
a lot of work.
Yeah, it's hard to carry them along. You know, nothing to talk about either. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's true. You do kind of lose the ability to talk to them. You just grow apart. You know, when you deal with like, if you go into a career that you like, so you start getting really absorbed in it, and you kind of become an expert on it. It just inhibits your ability to talk to other people about, like, the Kardashians and things like that.
Dancing with the Stars.
You know, like, all these people are mentioning all these actresses and movies that I've never watched and haven't heard of. And I remember it wasn't that long ago. I used to know every movie that came out. And I was like, man, I think I'm falling down the black hole that everyone in my field does.
But
I'm ending up there.
Isn't it funny though that when you do talk to people outside of your line of work, and they do mention things like that, or even professional sports, which is something I've just never really had an interest in. I just think, gosh, how much time do you waste in your life that you're never going to get back, worrying about people you're never going to meet, and watching, you know, pro teams that...
And yet, when you talk to them about politics, they're like...
They're totally lost.
They have no idea who any of the people are. Yeah, the secretary of the what?
Yeah.
What do they do?
They know everything.
But, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's pretty funny.
They all have an opinion.
They've got all the answers. They won't ask you a question. They'll give you an answer, though.
Yeah,
that's a great point. Yeah, but I'm always amazed by what people do spend their time.
And they all think we're crazy, of course. They're having the same right now. They're having
the same
conversation
about
us.
It's like, you guys need to get a life.
You people need to get out more.
Yeah.
Now, well, the problem is now not all of them, but a sizable portion of the athletes think we care what they have to say when it comes to politics.
Yeah, and how unfortunate that has been. That's been a real, that's called a CLM, actually. I learned about that a long time ago. It's a career limiting move.
Yes.
I've actually never heard that.
Yes, so, yes.
I, with these football players, though, when I retire, I'm probably going to become a violent old man. Where it doesn't matter if I get a criminal record, there's a good chance I'm going to find, like, Colin Kaepernick and just, like, slap him.
my mom, I've said this before, but honestly, my mom's very, very nice, really. She's way nicer than any of her kids, actually. But we were at a ball game years ago, and this guy would not take his hat off during the national anthem. My mom went berserk. She literally reached over other people and smacked this guy in the back of the head. And she was like, "Cat, quick, too." It's like, that was usually my dad's
take
signature
off your
move.
Hat, sonny.
It was, and the guy like whipped around, and my mom's like, "Take your hat off." And I thought, who was that? Like, that was as close to possession as anyone in my family's ever been. That was just like, she was somebody else. But you look at that now, honestly, you'd probably be up for assault. We don't take my mom out in public anymore, so we've solved that problem. At least to nothing. We don't take her to anything patriotic. No sporting events of any kind.
Yeah, well, if you want to do something patriotic, you can't go to a sporting event now, because now it's all the game of like, oh, who's gonna stand, who's not. It's, oh, God. Something's going on with our culture. It's just like... Where I think part of it, again, is that 24/7 news cycle where it's like you used to have time off from it, everyone, but now you go on to like Facebook to look at cat pictures and you have news headlines like over on the right-hand side. So people are getting overly emotional about things because you're just getting reminded of it all the time. And if you don't have the type of brain that is real analytical and looks at that from a research perspective, like I just love the political science of it all.
I do too.
I can remove myself from the emotion.
Yeah.
Then you are going to get like real crazy, and you also are going to get arrogant because you're like, oh, I see these headlines all the time. I'm very educated, without realizing that you're just getting a headline over and over again.
Yeah.
As opposed to a book. Where each sentence is different.
Well, how about my favorite Facebook ones are the ones where people write these long manifestos about how they're breaking up with their friends because they can no longer tolerate, you know, the intolerance of the tolerating of the intolerance. It just goes on, and you're like...
And the microaggressions.
It's like, hey, wait a minute, I think that guy broke up with all his friends like a month ago. He's doing it again. Slowly whittling them out like one little herd at a time. It's kind of sad, actually.
Yeah, I saw that on Facebook. A lot of people saying, oh, just delete me if you voted for Trump.
Yes.
And I've seen so less people, you know, saying the same thing about Hillary or Obama, and I'm like, what type of life do you lead? And the projection there is something, it's just a classic example for psychology students to study, where the example I used to give, and I now give the one you just mentioned, but the other example I used to give would be like on a dating website, and if a woman puts, I really hate drama, no drama, I hate drama, the fact that she has to say that in her profile means
Yippers.
That she is the source of drama.
Yes, that means she has a lot of drama.
It surrounds her.
And causes a lot of drama because she likes drama.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's funny, and there are a lot of men who don't really actually see through that, which is sort of humorous.
I don't get it.
Until they get divorced, and it's not that humorous anymore. But,
yeah.
Well, yeah, sorry, we just sort of burned through that little bit of time frame. We had this little off-air, on-air talk.
Yeah, we don't like drama either.
No, we don't like drama either. All right, we're going to take a quick break and come right back with Ryan. We're going to talk about something important when we come back. Mostly, I'm not going to ask any questions. Ryan, you just launch in and go to something important we need to know, okay?
All right.
So I don't get you off track and we start talking about nothing. That was like a Seinfeld episode we just had.
It was.
Yeah. Except you're listening to We the People. Join us online. WeThePeopleRadio.us. Where Seinfeld just happens.
A whole segment about nothing?
Okay. Exactly.
You're talking, it all sounds fair. You promise your love, how much you care. I'm still listening, but still unsure.
She doesn't like drama. I can tell by the sound of her voice.
Just hold me.
Yeah. Love talking over the music. It's bad. People probably don't like it.
Yeah, like
if you don't
song.
Like it, you could email us. I'm just not going to tell you where. We're back with Ryan Morrow. All right, hit it, Ryan. What's important?
I think all the news right now is focusing on the Iran deal,
yeah.
And Trump decertifying it, which, again, is one of those things that it's significant because of the pressure it's putting on Iran and the countries that trade with Iran, but it's not... If people are making it sound like that means he's just pulled out of the nuclear deal with Iran, that the U.S. is going rogue, and that's not what's happening because the deal is so complicated in how it was set up and approved that they don't understand what's happening. There are actually two sets of standards in regards to how the U.S. is handling the nuclear issue with Iran, which is the first standard is whether Iran is in actually complying with the deal itself. Trump says that they're not, cites some relatively minor violations, and then some people argue that those aren't actually violations. Whatever, put that to the side. The second standard is the standard for the U.S. to remain in the deal. There was an agreement between Congress and the president that basically said that Iran's had to meet these other standards, which includes upholding the spirit of the deal, that sanctions would remain in the national security interests of the U.S., that Iran would comply with what was vaguely called related agreements. And by any standard, Iran is not meeting that second set of standards for the U.S. and the presidency and the Congress to have America continue in the deal. So what Trump has basically said is that Iran is not meeting that second standard, and now it is up to Congress to debate whether we stick with the deal and also how we can improve it. So we may end up improving it, we may end up withdrawing from it, but at least now it begins that process of addressing the weaknesses in the deal and maximizing pressure on Iran and those that trade with the regime there.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So they they get to keep the money. Right now they're inspecting themselves. So let's say we did nothing. What does that do? Where is that, good or bad? I mean, it seems bad, but...
Well, we can't really go to a spot where we do nothing because Trump just ordered the Treasury Department to treat the entire Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps as a terrorist group, which is the wing of the regime that keeps it in power and controls at least a third of the Iranian economy. So that's a big deal. That makes it very difficult for countries to trade with Iran because you don't know what's a front organization for the Revolutionary Guards. You don't know if the construction company, which the Revolutionary Guards is really involved in, you don't know if this construction company that sounds completely separate and independent is actually a front for them. And so why would you do business with them when you could get sanctioned for it, they could get sanctioned, the whole thing could collapse. So we are in a new situation now. The Europeans are complaining, but that's because top business executives that are connected to the top politicians have been going back and forth from Europe to Iran and striking up these contracts to make lots and lots of blood money. So we're in a new situation now. Iran's already saying that they're willing to negotiate over their ballistic missile program, which they previously said they would not be. So Iran is scared. Behind their bluster and their shouts of death to America, you're seeing some signs of fear.
That's kind of great. So why? What's the motivation on the left? Really, for besides the fact that, you know, everything Trump says is bad, blah, 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 same stuff. But why would they want to keep the deal in place the way it is?
They have a few different arguments. The chief one saying that you risk compelling Iran to just run full force towards a nuclear weapon, because the sites that are overt that they have declared, all of them they hit at one point, but they declared after they were found. There are inspections there. The activity at those sites is being limited, whereas before it was not limited. And so they say, well, this is at least with the overt signs of the program and the inspections that could detect covert activity, it's keeping it in a box, even though the Iranian regime is going to be getting rich over time and this strengthens Iran. It's worth keeping them in that box. Otherwise, if they start dashing towards a nuclear weapon, you might have to take military action. You get yourself into a war. So there's some reasonable logic behind that, and so they say something is better than nothing, and this is a big something. And then when it comes to the issue of, well, what about, aren't you strengthening the Iranian regime, there's a flawed argument, but this is the common argument, that the trade with the outside world will moderate the regime, that it will lead to an opening, and then that will lead to it maximizes the chance for an evolution within the regime, so the regime changes or it falls over time.
Hmm. But, you know, you say a run towards nuclear development. If they're self-inspecting, how do we know they're not already doing that?
Well, some of their sites are inspected by the inspectors, by the IAEA, but then anything that they consider to be a military site, specifically it's one site at Parchin that's been involved in developing nuclear warheads, they are self-inspected, but they have, like, cameras on the outside, and Iran could hide stuff there, but there's enough surveillance that some activity would be detected that we could inquire about. I still don't think it's enough, but that's the argument. Now the question is, what if Iran has covert sites? The Israelis say that they do have information about covert sites that the IAEA, the UN, is not requesting access to. The UN saying that the evidence is not enough. You have Iranian opposition groups who collect intelligence with a very good track record within Iran saying that they know of specific hidden nuclear sites. They even provided the coordinates on the internet and published Google pictures to show where the tunnel construction was happening. So this current situation, the risk is that if we go along with the deal, you're going to have an Iranian regime that has the money and the means to already covertly pursue a nuclear weapon, but then when they really want to start developing a nuclear bomb, they'll have such a large infrastructure that they quickly get an arsenal. So it won't be about dashing towards a single nuclear bomb. It'll be about flipping the switch, and then all of a sudden they have dozens of nuclear weapons.
Okay. So is that...
And who is selling them uranium? We have a question in the chat room. It's actually people in the chat room.
Well, they're mining it themselves now.
Oh.
So they have their own uranium mines, which they've been expanding.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
God, isn't that fantastic?
They're expanding that, and then also they were importing some from Venezuela and shopping around for some in Africa because there is a shortage at one point, but they're addressing that shortage by expanding their own mines.
And Venezuela is so well organized right now, I'm sure that's got real tight controls on that.
Yeah, there's also no information indicating that uranium's going there right now, but there's been talk in the past. And Venezuela, despite being a Marxist dictatorship over there, which you would assume would be atheist and hates radical Islam, but they are actually allied with Iran. So the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, the terrorist wing of the regime, is operating there. There's indications that Hezbollah is there. So it's actually a quite tight alliance, just like you see with Iran and North Korea, even though there's no compatibility between their ideologies except for the fact that they hate America and they hate the Jews.
Yeah, well, at least they're organized. They always hate all the guys who like each other. When we come back, if you don't mind, kind of in the last part of this, before we all have to go back and do boring things in our life again and stop goofing off on the radio, somebody in the chat room said, this is like being on a party line with our little random segment there in the middle. I would like you to speak a little bit about why, going back to discussing the whole Islamism, you know, why bringing that up again in that speech was so important. I mean, I've got a million opinions on that, but I'd like to know what you see there and what that bodes for us, since obviously the last 8 years, you know, or the previous 8 years, we didn't talk about that at all for any reason. Very unfortunate. We're going to be right back with Ryan Morrow from the Clarion Project. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeople.us. Sorry.
Come back.
Wethepeopleradio.us. Sorry, I got it.
That's better.
We were due. We don't want Ryan to get the wrong impression of us. All right, Ryan.
What was I thinking?
What were you thinking? Okay, so throwing down a little bit on the Islamism and all that, what does that do for us? Because I know other people are gasping, oh, how dare he bring that up. But why do you think that's a good thing?
Well, basically, the idea is when you identify the enemy as Islamism or radical Islam, whatever it is, some type of Islamic vernacular,
right?
You force the Muslim world to debate what that is, and then as they take a stand on what that is and whether they oppose it, you can find your true ally. So, for example, the real secular democratic activists in the Muslim world, people who are privately devout Muslim, but they don't want to implement their faith as a political system, they have no problem with terms like radical Islam, jihadist, or Islamism, whatever you want to call it, because that doesn't threaten them. Those that then get really offended by it usually tend to have connections to groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. They're ones that may not be so radical as to do something like Al-Qaeda and ISIS does, but they are still in that category. They're like Hamas. They still want to implement a theocracy, Sharia law. So it's very difficult to tell friend from foe when you don't have that paradigm of what you're going after. And so we have to identify the enemy as being theocratic in nature, as ideological in nature, so that we can separate them and don't make mistakes like we've done in the past where we say, well, Iran is moderate compared to Al-Qaeda, so we should ally with them. Or the Muslim Brotherhood is moderate compared to Al-Qaeda, so we should ally with them, which has been the strategy in many ways since 9/11, to focus singularly on groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and view others as being non-issues or even being friends.
And do you think that's been effective?
It's only effective on the battlefield, I would say, when you're in a situation where if the two forces are actually shooting at each other and then you have American boots or American allies in the area, then it makes sense that you want those two forces to fight each other. But that usually isn't what happens. It's very complicated where, for example, Iran and Al-Qaeda might be on opposite sides in Syria, but then you'll find out that bin Laden is saying that the main artery of his organization is through Iran. The chief of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, might be in Iran right now. And so these folks, these jihadists that you think, because of their differences with each other, where they even kill each other, to think that there can be some type of meaningful temporary alliance with one jihadist against another is just going to backfire, because they can cooperate and kill each other at the same time, and in their psychology, that's consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's been that way for 1,000 years.
Yeah, it goes back to the founding of Islam, where you did have people being conquered, and you did have the values of the time being enshrined into religious rulings that then people say you can't budge from. Luckily, there's an increasing number of Muslims that are out there that are saying, well, this obviously isn't working. It's obviously not what God intended, so we need to start looking at things differently, discarding certain things, maybe not emulating the Prophet Muhammad in every single circumstance, because, after all, we drive cars, not camels. And so you're seeing changes happening in the Muslim world beneath the surface that isn't going to be a top headline. But you are seeing these voices increase, and it's encouraging. You've seen them lose elections in places like Tunisia and Libya, referring to the radical Islamic forces that once were popular. The Muslim Brotherhood came into power in Egypt and then was kicked out by an alliance of Muslims and Christians coming together. And there are a lot of stories like that that we have to remember when we look at the depressing world that we live in, that there are positive trends here and there are concrete reasons to believe that we're going to be victorious. And I don't think that this has to be a generations long struggle.
No, probably not. And there's a really large population of Iranian Americans. The organization of Iranian American communities that we've had on the show before, and those guys don't want any part of all the Sharia law and all those sorts of things. That's not where they're headed, and they don't want the religious guys running their country. That's why they left.
And exactly. The Iranian community in the United States and in Europe is exceptionally moderate. You'll find many atheists there, many non-practicing Muslims.
They're very secular, really. They're very very sensible people, and they're not, you know, kind of a bad word, but they're not lurking, you know. It isn't like pretending to be one thing. They said, hey, we want the Iran of the 70s when, you know, women drove and didn't have to wear, you know, burqas and all that stuff. They would like to go back to their country and see their relatives. But boy, anybody says anything about that now, they're
off with your head.
They're doomed.
Yeah, well, that's one of the big failures of our strategy since 9/11. I fault both Bush and Obama for that, and even Clinton, because this was the obvious solution even before 9/11, which is that we should have gotten materially behind those Iranian opposition groups that are fighting for that type of thing, because I'd much rather have them fight it than us, which is what's going to end up happening.
Well, and what they tell us all the time is they just want us to leave them alone so they can finish, you know, they want to get the job done, but we keep getting in the way.
Well, they do need our help. If you look at the Cold War, the anti-communist forces did need our help, and it's not always bombing and military stuff. It's just intelligence, propaganda, supplies, money. There's a whole range of creative things that you can do, and if we were able to do it during the Cold War when we didn't have the internet like we do today, then imagine what we could do today with weaker regimes and greater capabilities if we had a strategy like that and applied it not just to Iran but North Korea and all these other places. We could really wage an ideological war that would be much cheaper than the military effort.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of North Korea,
we have one minute. Could you please sum up the thing on North Korea?
What do you think is going to happen there, or can you even predict?
The odds are lots and lots of bloodshed. The hope is that North Korea is reacting to internal instability. That's what I assume. The dictator just gave an award to his sister, gave her a new rank. That indicates to me that a lot of these provocations is because the North Korean regime feels that having external conflict is the way it holds on to power.
Hmm.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, so I think so. The positive there would be that means that the regime understands that it's internally weak, and there are reports of them moving people out of the capital, being more vicious. We know that there's a black market in North Korea, so people are getting exposed to Western culture, and those trends are positive. But the question then arises, what do you do when the regime starts going down? What's the regime act like?
Right. How do you feel?
Well, in honor of our North Korean discussion, we have a special song at the end here. A little Rocket Man there.
Yeah, a little Rocket Man.
So thanks a lot, Ryan. We really appreciate it.
And
we want you to come back and play with us on a Sunday afternoon. If you can hang on for 2 seconds, I have a question for you off air when we cut out here. So hang with us for just a second. You've been listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll have a commercial free archive posted this afternoon. I'll have the full archive posted in about 20 minutes. And we will miss you next week, but please tune in. We have special substitute guests, and we'll be back with you at the end of the month with something fun. Maybe the Awan brothers.
They're substitute hosts.
Oh, substitute hosts. Sorry, the guests are always substitutes. I got that backwards. I was all focused on getting out of my chair and going and asking Ryan a question. Thanks so much for listening.
And I think it's going to be a long, long time. Touchdown brings me round and get to find. I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, no, no. I'm a rocket man.
7 years of promise. This is KCNR Shasta Redding.